When Jan Wenner interviewed John Lennon for Rolling Stone magazine in 1970, he knew it was going to be dynamite. The singer was yearning to talk, for the very first time and in candid detail, about the breakup of the Beatles, the hypocrisy of Beatlemania, and his ruptured relationship with the other members of the group, especially Paul McCartney. The interview, in which Lennon frequently swears, was recorded on reel-to-reel tape, with Yoko at his side throughout. BBC Radio 4 presents, for the first time on UK radio, Lennon, the Wenner Tapes.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small.
I'm Jan Wenner, founder and editor and publisher of Rolling Stone magazine.
By giving you no time instead of it all.
In December of 1970, here in New York City, I interviewed John Lennon on tape for Rolling Stone. An edited version of the interview appeared in print the following year.
The unfortunate thing about egomaniacs is they don't take much attention of other people's work. I only assess people on whether they're a danger to my work or not.
It's a reel-to-reel tape recorder, and I think that we had maybe one, maybe two mics at most, and both of those were set on the table on tripods aimed at one at John, one at Yoko. And I was at the head of the table, I believe, or somewhere at the side, but I wasn't really recording my voice at all. This wasn't here to make an accurate broadcast quality tape.
Jan is a very wise and also clever journalist, in a sense that he's a good listener. And because of that, I think John went on and on. I didn't want to be just go shutting up so that John start to worry about me or something like that. I wanted to show that I was there with him. I was there for him. But at the same time, I wanted to not say too much. I wanted to be the B-side.
I knew that what we were getting embarking on was going to be major, because I had talked to John Lennon, and I knew what he was feeling, I knew what he was thinking, and I knew what he was prepared to say.
Paul fell for that bullshit because he's got some kind of East Coast suit, you know, form and not substance, and that's McCartney.
When I did the interview, I was 24 years old. At the same time, looking back, John was 30. And there the both of us are talking about matters of the world and big judgments and major conclusions about life.
I'm interested in expressing myself that will mean something to people in any country, in any language, and at any time in history.
No parameters were set by John and Yoko. There was nothing off limits.
One has to completely humiliate oneself to be what the Beatles were. And that's what I resent, you know. Complete craziness is surrounding you, and you're doing exactly what you don't want to do with people you can't stand.
The timing was that in his mind, the Beatles is over. He had announced it, or thought he had. He had just completed work on his first solo album without the Beatles, the first time ever. It was a very cathartic record. So he was really ready to talk and prepared to talk.
A working class hero is something to be.
He was dying to be unburdened of all the stuff that he'd been carrying around. And the only way he could feel he could get free is to break the chains himself.
If you want to be a hero, well, just follow me.
Don't be shy.
Are you pleased with your album?
Well, I learned a lot on this album, you know, technically, that I didn't have to learn so much before, because there's usually, I don't know, there'd be, say, George, Paul, and I would all be listening to it, and but this time, it was my album, and I didn't have to. It used to get a bit embarrassing in front of George and Paul, because we know each other so well. Oh, look, he's trying to be Elvis, oh, he's doing this now, you know. We were a bit super critical of each other, so we inhibited each other a lot. And now I had Yoko there, who sort of loved me, okay, so I can perform better. And I relaxed, you know. It's true to me that has been developing over the years from In My Life, like I'm a Loser, Help, Strawberry Fields. They were all personal records. I always wrote about me. I didn't really enjoy writing third-person songs about people who lived in concrete flats and things. I like first-person music. But because of my hang-ups and many other things, I would only now and then specifically write about me, you know. And now I wrote all about me, you know? And that's why I like it. It's me and nobody else.
For instance, on this album there's like practically no imagery at all.
No, because there was none in my head, you know. There's no hallucinations.
There's no newspaper taxi.
No, I was consciously writing poetry then. Mm-hmm. And that's self-conscious poetry, you know. But the poetry on this album is superior to anything I've done because it's not self-conscious in that way. I've had least trouble writing the songs of all time, you know.
No bullshit.
Yeah, no bullshit, is it? You know, I always liked simple rock and nothing else. And I was influenced by acid and got psychedelic, you know, like the whole generation. But really, I like rock and roll, you know.
Why did you choose the musician to use on this
record? I'm a very nervous person, really. I'm not as big-headed as this tape sounds, you know. This is me projecting through the fear, you know. But so I choose people that I know, rather than strangers, you know.
Like use Ringo.
Yeah.
Why do you get along with Ringo?
In spite of all the things, the Beatles really could play music together when they weren't uptight. And if I get a thing going, Ringo knows where to go, you know, like that. And he does what? We've played together so long that it fits, you know. I mean, that's the only thing I sometimes miss is being able to just sort of blink or make a certain noise and I know they'll all know where we're going on an ad-lib thing. But it's I don't miss it that much, you know.
You said that this would be the first Primal album.
When did I say that?
In California.
Yes, but I don't know.
Have you gone off that?
No, I haven't gone off. It's just like Primal was like another mirror, you know, and I just.
See, because he sort of like any artist, I suppose, but because he really wants to sort of be honest with himself in the album. The Primal scream is like a mirror, you know.
In a nutshell, a Primal Therapy allowed us to feel feelings continually. And those feelings usually make you cry. That's all. Before, I wasn't feeling things, that's all. I was having blocks to the feelings. When the feelings come through, you cry. It's as simple as that, really.
What is your concept of pain?
I don't know what you mean, really.
Well, on the song God,
yes,
it starts off by saying God is a concept by which we measure our pain.
Well, pain is the pain we go through all the time, you know, and like you're born in pain, you know, and pain is what we're in most of the time. And I think that the bigger the pain, the more gods we need, you know. God is a concept by which we measure our pain. God was stuck together from three songs almost. I had the idea, God is a concept by which we measure our pain, so when you have a word like that, you just sit down and sing the first tune that comes into your head, and the tune is the simple, God is a concept, boom, 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 you know, because I like that kind of music, and then I just rolled into it, I don't believe in magic, and it was just going on in my head, and I Ching and Bible, and the first three or four just came out, whatever came out, you know. I don't know when I realized I was putting down all these things that I didn't believe in, you know. So I could have gone on. It was like a Christmas card list, you know. I thought, well, where do I end? You know, Churchill and who have I missed out? I got like that, you know. And I thought, I had to stop, you know. So, yeah, and then I was going to leave a gap and say, just fill in your own, you know, put whoever you don't believe in. It was just got out of hand, you know. So, but Beatles was the final thing because It's like I no longer believe in myth, you know. And Beatles is another myth. You know? I don't believe in it. The dream's over. It's over, you know. And we gotta, well, I have anyway, personally, gotta get down to so-called reality. I don't believe in Beatles. I just believe in me.
What we knew in advance going into it was going to be a major interview. This was going to be an interview where he talked for the first time ever in a frank and complete and full way about himself and the Beatles. Therefore, it was inevitably going to be long. You had a long career to deal with, a long history, and the fact that he had never spoken much about any of this at all before. His whole past and the story of the Beatles had been only presented in a scrubbed up, cleaned up, blemish-free, packaged, sanitized version for consumption as the four mop tops. So it was starting from scratch with lots of territory to cover.
We were always self-conscious, and Beatles super self-conscious people, about parodying Americans, which we do and have done. I know we developed our own style, but we still, in a way, parody American music. See, like, this is interesting, because in the early days in England, all the groups were like Elvis and the backing group, and the Beatles deliberately didn't move like Elvis. That was our policy, because we found it stupid and bullshit, you know. And then Mick Jagger came out and resurrected bullshit movement, you know, whittling your arse and that. Then people began to say, well, the Beatles are passé because they don't move. But we did it as an intellectual. When we were younger, we used to move, we used to jump around and do all the things they're doing now, like smashing things up. A thing that Pete Townsend sort of worked out, it's something that you do when you play 6 or 7 hours, there's nothing else to do, you smash the place up, and you insult everybody, you know. But we were groomed, you know, and we dropped all that. We were four guys that I met Paul and said, do you want to join the band, you know? And then George joined. And then Ringo joined. We were just a band who made it very, very big, that's all. You know? And sometimes our best work was never recorded, you know. Because we were performers in Liverpool, Hamburg and around the dance halls, you know. And what we generated was fantastic when we played straight rock. And there was nobody to touch us in Britain, you know. But as soon as we made it, we made it. The edges were knocked off. You know, Brian put us in suits and all that. And we made it very, very big. But we sold out, you know. See, we believed the Beatles myth too. You know? I don't know whether the others still believe it. But and the music was dead before we even went on the theatre tour of Britain. We were feeling shit already. Because we had to reduce an hour or 2 hours playing, which we were glad in one way, to 20 minutes. And go on and repeat the same 20 minutes every night. The Beatles' music died then as musicians. That's why we never improved, you know. As musicians, we killed ourselves then to make it. Love, love me do. Love me do is rock and roll, you know. We didn't sound like everybody else at all. I mean, we didn't sound like black musicians because we weren't black and et cetera, et cetera, and because we were brought up on a different kind of music and atmosphere.
The first
gimmick was the harmonica, and I played a lot of harmonica, mouth organ, really was, when I was a child. So we did those numbers, and so we started using it on Love Me Do, you know, and then we stuck it on Please Please Me, and then we stuck it on From Me to You, like that, you know, it went on and on, it got into a gimmick, and then we dropped it, it got embarrassing. And then later on we became technically efficient recording artists, which was another thing, because we were competent people, you know, and we can, whatever media you put us in, we can produce something worthwhile.
while he was full of attitude and airs, there was something very earthy about John. There was no pretense there. There was a lot of arrogance, but no pretense. And what you have here is the urgency and power of a man still in the battle, still young, still thinking about it, just fresh out of the maelstrom and fresh out of the storm and finally in port, but he's still reeling and seasick from the whole thing. It was tough stuff.
Man, our tours were like something else. If you could get on our tours, you were in, you know.
Would you go to a town, a hotel?
Wherever we went, there was always a whole scene going. We had our four bedrooms separate from, tried to keep them out of our room, and Derek and Neil's rooms were always full of junk and whores and fuck knows what and policemen and everything. Well, we had to do something. And what do? The pill doesn't wear off when it's time to go. You just I used to be up all night with Derek, whether there was anybody there or not. You know, I just couldn't ever sleep. Such a heavy scene it was. Like anybody, that they're all into now, but they didn't call them groupies then, they called it something else. But if you couldn't get groupies, we'd have whores and everything, whatever was going, you know. So, I mean, when we hit town, we hit it, you know, we're not pissing about. But, you know, there's photographs of me, God knows, they're crawling about in Amsterdam on my knees, coming out of whore houses and things like that, and people saying, good morning, John, and all that. And the police escorting me to the places and things like that. You know, because they never wanted a big scandal, you see. I don't really want to talk about it, because it hurt Yoko, you know. I'm sorry.
I was surprised, you know, I didn't know things like that. I thought, well, John is an artist, and probably...
How did artists live?
Two or three affairs, you know.
Those things are left out, you know, about what bastards we were. With, you know, I mean, big bastards, that's what the Beatles were.
Yeah,
you have to be a bastard to make it, man, and that's a fact, and the Beatles were the biggest bastards on earth.
So how did you manage to keep that clean image? It's amazing.
Because everybody wants the image to carry on, the press around with you want to carry on because they want the free drinks and the free whores and the fun, everybody wants to keep in the background. We were the Caesar. Who was going to knock us when there's £1 million to be made? All the handouts, the bribery of the police, all the hype, you know? Everybody wanted in, you know? Everybody. That's why some of them are still trying to cling on to this. Mm. Don't take it away from us, you know? Don't take Rome from us, not a portable Rome. Where we all have our houses and our cars and our lovers and our wives and office girls and parties and drink and drugs. Don't take it from us. You know, otherwise you're mad, John. You're crazy. You know, silly John wants to take all this away. Mm. See, a lot of people, all those Dick James and the Derek Taylors and Peter Brown, all of them, you know, they think they're the Beatles and Neil and all of them. Well, I say, fuck them. You know, and they all, after working with genius for 10, 15 years, begin to think they're it, you know. So, they're not.
Do you think you're genius?
Yes. If there's such a thing as one, I am one, you know.
When did you first
realize? When I was about 12, you know. I used to think, I must be a genius, but nobody's noticed. And I thought, well, I'm a genius or I'm mad? Which is it? I said, I can't be mad because nobody's put me away, therefore I'm a genius. I mean, genius is a form of madness, and we're all that way, you know. But I used to be a bit coy about it, like my guitar playing, you know. If there's such a thing as genius, which is just what? I am one, you know. And if there isn't, I don't care, you know. But I used to think when I was a kid, you know, writing my poetry and doing my paintings. I didn't become something when the Beatles made it or when you heard about me. I've been like this all my life. Genius is pain, too. It's just pain, you know. Creating is a result of pain, too. I have to put it somewhere. And I write songs, you know.
Well, I'm sure that he knew that he was a genius, but I don't think that it's being such an ego to just tell the truth. I mean, he knew that he was a genius. It sounds very strong because now there's nobody who's really speaking out in that sense. We're all very careful. We have to be careful to survive. But in his Beatle days, he could not be that truthful. And so the whole thing came out almost like a gush of wind.
How would you describe Beatles?
Beatle music. Well, it means a lot of things to me. You know, there's not one thing that's Beatle music, because how can I? I'm part of it. Some You know, what is Beatle music? Walrus or Penny Lane?
It's Beatle.
Which? Or, I mean, it's that diverse. Or I Want to Hold Your Hand or Revolution Number 9.
What do you think are your best songs?
Ever.
Ever. What is the best song?
The one best song.
Have you thought of that?
I always like Walrus, Strawberry Fields, Help, In My Life. Those are some favourites, you know.
Why Help?
Because I meant it. It's real. It's the lyric is as good now as it was then. It's no different, you know. And it makes me feel secure to know that I was that sensible or whatever, you know. That not sensible, but aware of myself. Then that's when, with no acid, no nothing, you know. That's pot or whatever. That didn't mean a thing, really. Yeah. It was just me singing Help, and I meant it, you know.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone. Help. When I was younger, so much younger than today, I never needed anybody's help in any way. Now these days are gone, I'm not so self-assured. I change my mind and open up the doors. Help me if you can, I'm feeling down.
There's many songs I forget like that, you know, that I do like. But I like Across the Universe too.
Why?
Because it's one of the best lyrics I've written, you know. In fact, it could be the best, I don't know. I mean, it's one of the best, you know. It's good poetry, you know, or whatever you call it. Without tune, it stands. The ones I like are ones that stand as words, you know, without melody. They don't have to have any melody. It's a poem, you know, you could read them.
Words are flowing out like endless rain into a paper cup. They slither wildly as they slip away across the universe. Joy are drifting through my opened mind, possessing and caressing me. Chakuru-deva.
The intensity and the breadth of the popularity of the Beatles was so overwhelming, and that's what was weighing on his shoulders. It wasn't just the myth-making, it wasn't just the Fab Four fans, it wasn't just the hippie fans, it was the whole thing was too much. When he said, we were more famous than Jesus, it was true.
Why do you think the impact of the Beatles so much bigger in America than it was in England?
Grass is greener, and we really were professional by the time we got here. We learned the whole game, you know. When we arrived here, we knew how to handle press, the British press are the toughest in the world, we could handle anything. We were all right. I know on the plane over I was thinking, oh, we won't make it, or I said it on a film somewhere, you know. But that's the side, that's that side of it. We knew we would wipe them out if we could just get a grip on you, you know. So we were new, and we didn't look, I mean, when we got here, you were all walking around in Bermuda shorts with Boston crew cuts and stuff on your teeth, you know, and the chicks looked like 1940s horses, you know. I mean, there was no conception of dress or any of that jazz, you know. We just thought, what an ugly race. What an ugly race with, you know, it looked just disgusting, you know. And we thought how hip we were, you know. But you tend to get nationalistic. We used to really laugh at America, you know, except for its music. And it was the black music we dug. You know, we thought we were coming to the land of its origin.
What was it like in the early days in London when you, you know, first...
When we came down, we were treated like provincials, you know, by the Cockneys.
What was it like, you know, running around the attacks with the stone?
Oh, that was a great period, you know. We were like king of the jungle then, you know, and we were very close to the Stones. So I don't know how close the others were. I spent a lot of time with Brian and Mick, and I admired them, you know, and spent a lot of time with them, you know, and it was great, you know. We were kings, and we all, you know, just at the prime, and we all used to just go around London in our cars and meet each other and talk about music with the animals, and Eric and all that. And we were, it was really a good time. That was the best period for fame-wise, you know. We didn't get mobbed so much as this, I don't know, it was like a men's smoking club. Just very good scene.
What do you think of the Stones today?
I think Mick's a joke, you know, with all that fag dancing. And I always was very respectful about Mick of the Stones, but he said a lot of sort of tarty things about the Beatles, which I am hurt by, you know, because I can knock the Beatles, but don't let Mick Jagger knock them, you know, because I'd like to just list what we did and what the Stones did 2 months after on every fucking album, and everything we did, Mick does exactly the same. He imitates us. And I'd like one of you fucking underground people to point it out, you know. Let It Bleed. Satanic Majesties is Pepper. We love them. That's all you need is love, you know. I resent the implication that the Stones are like revolutionaries and that the Beatles weren't, you know. If the Stones were or are, the Beatles really were. They're not in the same class, music-wise, or power-wise. Never were, and Mick always resented it. He's obviously so upset by how big the Beatles are compared with him, and he never got over it, that he's now in his old age, he's beginning to knock us, you know. And he keeps knocking because now the Beatles have, like, everybody jumped in on the bandwagon to knock Beatles when we split.
There are places I remember all my life, though some have changed, some forever, not for better. Some have gone and some remain. All these places had their moments with lovers and friends. I still can recall some are dead and some.
John's feelings towards Paul were multiple, they were ambiguous, they're clear, they're contradictory, there's all levels of them, and in this interview he expresses his attitude towards Paul in all different ways, ranging in a full range from love and admiration to anger and hatred and bitterness, and you know, the depth of the relationship we can only imagine. I saw Let It Be with John and Yoko in an empty theater in San Francisco. It was a very emotional experience. It was a very sad experience for all of us.
I felt sad. That film was set up by Paul, for Paul. That's one of the main reasons the Beatles ended. You know, because I can't speak for George, but I pretty damn well know. We got fed up of being sidemen for Paul. After Brian died, that's what began to happen to us, you know.
How would you trace the breakup of the Beatles?
After Brian died, we collapsed. Paul took over and supposedly led us, you know. But what is leading us when we went round in circles? We broke up then. That was the disintegration. You know? We'd be here a long time, so.
Where were you when Brian died?
We were in Wales with Maharishi. We'd just gone down after seeing his lecture the first night. And we went down to Wales and we heard it then, yeah. And they said Brian's dead, and I was stunned, you know, and we all were, I suppose. And the Maharishi, we went into, well, what, you know he's dead and all that, and he was sort of saying, oh, forget it, you know, be happy, fucking idiot, you know, like parents, you know, smile. That's what Maharishi said, yeah. So, and we did, and we were along with the Maharishi trip, you know.
What was your feeling when Brian died?
The feeling that anybody has when somebody close to them dies, there's a sort of little hysterical sort of hee-hee and glad it's not me or something in it. You know, that funny feeling when somebody dies, I don't know whether you've had it, I've had a lot of people die on me, you know. Mm-hmm. And the other feeling is, what can I do, you know? I mean, I knew that we were in trouble then. I didn't really have any misconceptions about our ability to do anything other than play music. And I was scared, you know. I thought, we've fucking had it now.
So Brian died, and then you said, then what happened is Paul started to take over.
Well, that's... Paul, I don't know how much of this I want to put out, I tell you. I think Paul had an impression, he has it now, like a parent, that we should be thankful for what he did, you know. But he kept for keeping the Beatles going. But when you look upon it objectively, he kept it going for his own sake, you know. But not for my sake, did he? Paul's struggle. But Paul made an attempt to carry on as if Brian hadn't died, you know, by saying, now, boys, we're going to make a record. You know, and being the kind of person I am, I thought, well, you know, we're going to make a record, all right. So I went along, we went and made a record. I think Paul had a tendency to come along and say, well, he's written his 10 songs, let's record now. And I said, well, give us a few days, and I'll knock a few off, you know.
When did your songwriting partnership with Paul end?
That ended, I don't know, around 1962 or something, I don't know. I mean, if you give me the albums, I can tell you exactly who wrote what, you know. And which line? I mean, we sometimes wrote together and sometimes didn't, but all our best work, apart from the early days, like I Want to Hold Your Hand, we wrote together and things like that. We wrote apart always, you know. But we wrote together because we enjoyed it a lot sometimes, and also because they'd say, well, you're going to make an album, we'd get together and knock off a few songs, you know. Just like a job.
You said, I mean, Sergeant Pepper's was the one. That was the album.
Well, it was a peak, you know. And Paul and I definitely were working together, especially on Day in the Life, you know. That was a real...
How did that come together?
Well, see, the way we wrote a lot of the time was you'd write the good bit, you know, that was easy. Like, I read the news today, a boy, or whatever it was, or Day Trip, or anything like that. And then when you got to... stuck, you know, instead of carrying on, whenever it got hard, you'd just drop it, and then we'd meet each other, and I'd sing half, and he'd be inspired to write the next bit and vice versa. And then he came up with that, and he was a bit shy about saying it, because I think he thought, well, it's a good song, you know, sometimes we wouldn't let each other interfere with the song either, because you tend to be a bit lax with somebody else's stuff, you experiment a bit. So he was saying, I think he was saying, just like we were doing it, you know, in his room with the piano, and he's saying, would you I don't know, it just happened, you know, should we do this or something? Yeah, let's do that, and that's how it happened.
Have the mic on the piano quite low, just keeping it like maracas, you know. You know those old pianos. Okay, well.
Sugarbum fairy, sugarbum fairy.
Only after I read it, or somebody told me, like you coming up
even
about.
I didn't even
see it on the label. No, I didn't look at the initials. I don't go. I mean, I never play things backwards. I just listen to it as I made it. Every time after, I would look at the titles, you know, see what it said. It never said anything. But Pepper was a peak, all right.
But in a way, you know, the thing is... People,
hello.
Yeah. People say something like, oh, that's the peak, you know. And I'm just so amazed that... I secretly thought that too. Well, John's done all that Beatles stuff and everything, you know. But this new album of John's is a real peak, you know. That's higher than any other thing that...
Thank you, dear.
Do you think it is?
Yeah, sure. Mm. I think it's, you know...
Revolution.
Paul possessed elements that John would have wanted to have as well. In other words, Paul was extremely charming to the world, and because of his diplomacy and charm, I think that the band flourished in a way. Whereas John's role was to really bring that spiritually nourishing energy to the band, and that really helped the band to survive and to expand and to be successful. They were taking two different roles. They were complementing each other, yeah.
What do you think of George's album?
I don't know, you know. I think it's all right, you know. I mean, I don't know how to say about it, you know. I think it's better than Paul's.
What are you saying of Paul?
I thought Paul's was rubbish, you know. I think he'd make a better one when he's frightened into it. But I thought that first one was just a load of... I told you, light and whatever, you know, that
right.
crack.
Were you surprised when you heard it, at what he had done?
Yeah, I was surprised it was so poor, you know. I expected just a little more, you know. I mean, because if Paul and I are sort of disagreeing, and I feel weak, I think he must feel strong, you know. That's in an argument. So I was just surprised, you know. And I was glad too, you know. I suddenly got it all in perspective, you know.
What do you think Paul was going to be your album?
I think it'll probably scare him, you know, into doing something decent. And then he'll scare me into doing something decent, and I'll scare him like that. I think he's capable of great work, you know. I think he will do it. I wish he wouldn't, you know. I wish nobody would, Dylan or anybody, you know. I mean, in my heart of hearts, I wish I was the only one in the world, you know, or whatever it is. But I can't see him doing it twice.
What do you think of Dylan?
I haven't been a Dylan follower since he stopped rocking, you know. I like Rolling Stone and a few things he did then, you know. I like a few things he did in the early days, but the rest of it's just like, you know, McCartney or something, you know. It's just no different, you know. It's a myth.
Assess the talents of George.
I don't want to assess them, you know. George has not done his best work yet. His talents have developed over the years, and he was working with two fucking brilliant songwriters, and he learned a lot from us. And I wouldn't mind it being George, the Invisible Man, and learning what he learned. So I don't know, you know. But just personally, I think it's nothing, you know. I think something was a nice tune, but it doesn't mean anything to me. I don't consider my talents fantastic compared with the fucking universe, but I consider George's less. As an artist, I can only consider myself. And
how do you rate yourself over the guitar?
I'm not technically very good, but I can make it howl, you know, and move. I was rhythm guitarist, you know, and it's an important job. I can make a band drive, you know. See, one part of me says, yes, of course I can play, because I can make a rock move, you know. But the other part of me says, well, I wish I could just do it like B.B. King, you know. If you put me with B.B., I feel silly, you know. But I can really make I'm an artist, and if you give me a tuba, I'll bring you something out of it. Now, ask Eric Clapton, he thinks I can play. Ask him, you know. That I have a definite style of playing. I always had, but I was overshadowed. Like they call about George the Invisible Singer. I'm the Invisible Guitarist, you know.
JoJo was a man who thought he was a loner, but he knew it couldn't last. JoJo left his home in Tucson, Arizona, for some California grass. Get back.
You said you played the obligato on Get Back.
I played the solo on that, yeah. When Paul was feeling kind, he'd give me a solo, you know. If he was feeling guilty that he'd had most of the A-sides or something, he'd give me a solo, you know. And I played the solo on that. I think George produces some beautiful guitar playing, you know. But I think he's too hung up to really let go. But so is Eric, really, you know. But maybe he's changed. They're all so hung up, you know. Well, we all are, that's the problem. But I really like B.B. King.
Get back, back to where you once belong. Get back, Joe.
People were giving us such a hard time. No, but we got such a hard time from everyone, you know. And I've had so much shit thrown at me and at Yoko, especially at Yoko. People just... And that's going on all the time, you know, and we get in so much pain that we have to do something about it, you know. And that's what happened to us, you know. We took AIDS because of what the Beatles and their pals were doing to us. Heroin was not too much fun, you know. I never injected it, and we sniffed a little, you know, when we were in real pain. See, I presumed that I would just be able to carry on and just bring Yoko into our life, but it seemed that I had to be married to them or Yoko, and I chose Yoko, you know, and I was right.
It was very, very difficult. We stood alone, in a way. I think that we were just holding each other in this incredible storm around us. I think it's quite surprising, even when you think about it now, that people are so against it all. Why? It's true that they did hurt John deeply, and basically we felt that they didn't really want us there. Most of this animosity came from them rather than the world initially, and it was kind of slipped out, I suppose, from the headquarters.
They despised her, you know.
From the very beginning?
Yeah, right. Yeah. And they insult her, and they still do.
The
yeah, they don't even know I can see it. I know, you know, just by the way the publicity on us was handled in Apple, all the 2 years we were together, and the attitude of people to us, and the bits we hear from the office girls, and we know, you know, so they can go stuff themselves.
In the beginning, we were too much in love to notice.
Yeah, we were in our own dream, you know. There's many times at first he hated Yoko. Why should she take that kind of shit from those people? She's with the most big-headed love someone. That's in Apple office at the beginning, because this is what I've heard, and Dylan and a few people, that's what George said to her, and we both sat through it, and I did, you know. And they all sat there with their wives.
That you're just not going to be unable to reconcile.
When I decided to leave the group, you know. Yeah, I mean, I wanted, you know, Yoko played me a tape, so I understood her work. I know it was very strange, and avant-garde music is a tough thing to assimilate and all that. But I've heard the Beatles playing avant-garde music when nobody's looking for years, you know. But they're artists, and all artists have fucking big egos, whether they like to admit it or not. And when a new artist came into the group, there was never allowed. Now, sometimes George and I would like to bring somebody like Billy Preston. That was acceptable. We would have had him in the group, you know. We were fed up with the same old shit. But it wasn't wanted, and I would have expanded the Beatles, broken the myth, and get their pants off, you know, stop being God. But it didn't work. It didn't work. And Yoko was naive. She came in, would expect to perform with them like you would with any group. She was jamming, you know. But there'd be a sort of coldness about it, so. I mean, when I decided to leave the group, that's when I decided, you know, that I could no longer artistically get anything out of the Beatles, and here was somebody that could turn me on to a million things.
Why can't you be alone without Yoko?
But I can be alone without Yoko. I just have no wish to be here. There's no reason on earth why I should be alone. There's nothing more important than our relationship. Nothing. And we dig being together all the time. And both of us could survive apart, but what for? No. I'm not going to sacrifice love, friend, or any business, because in the end, you're alone at night, and neither of us want to be, and you can't fill the bed with groupies. It doesn't work. I don't want to be a swinger, you know, because it doesn't. Like I said in the song, I've been through it all. And nothing works better than to have somebody you love hold you.
Love is real. Real is love. To be
Paul kept making these attempts to revive the group, and one of them was Let It Be. So, of course, Let It Be has a lot of Paul in it. And when you look at it, much less John, it's really a film about Paul at the center of the Beatles, which is, of course, not the truth of it. But it ends up, again, an amazing record. You can see them disintegrating in Let It Be.
It was time for another Beatle movie or something. He wanted us to go on the road or do something, you know. And as usual, George and I were going, no, we don't want to do the fucking all that. And he sort of set it up, and there was all discussions about where to go and all that, and I would just tag along, and I had Yoko by then. I didn't even give a shit, you know, and nobody did, you know. And, you know, like in the movie, when I go to do Across the Universe, Paul yawns, you know, and plays Boogie, and I immediately say, oh, does anybody want to do a fast one? You know, that's how I am, you know. So that, year after year, that begins to wear you down.
How long did those sessions last?
Oh, God knows how long. Paul had this idea that we were going to rehearse and then make the album, you know, and of course we're lazy fuckers and we've been playing for 20 years, for fuck's sake. We're grown men, we're not going to sit around rehearsing, you know, and I'm not, anyway, and we couldn't get into it. And we put down a few tracks and nobody was in it at all. It just, I don't know, it was just a dreadful, dreadful feeling in Twickenham studio and being filmed all the time, you know, like that. I just wanted them to go away and we'd be there at 8 in the morning and you couldn't make music at 8 in the morning or 10 or whatever it was in a strange place with people filming you and coloured lights. You know.
How did it end?
So the tape ended up like the bootleg version. We let Glyn Johns remix it. And we didn't want to know, we just left it to him and said, here, do it. It's the first time since the first album that we didn't have anything to do with it. We just said, do it, you know. Glyn Johns did it. None of us could be bothered going in Nepal. Nobody called anybody about it, and the tapes were left there, and we got an acetate each, and we called each other and said, well, what do you think? Oh, let it out. We were going to let it out with that, with a really shitty condition, you know, disgusting. And I didn't care. I thought it was good to go out to show people what had happened to us, you know, like, this is where we're at now. We can't get it together. We don't play together anymore, you know, leave us alone. But that didn't happen, and Paul wouldn't, well, not wouldn't, we ended up doing Abbey Road quickly and putting out something slick to preserve the myth.
The legal wrangling between the two of them was just sort of inseparable also from the emotional wrangling and the creative wrangling and all of it. It was all of a piece. If they had seen eye to eye on any one piece of it, they would have seen eye to eye pretty much on all of it. But since it became a very bitter divorce, everything else is affected there. There was no place to find peace.
Brian was no good businessman. You know, he was he had a flair for presenting things. He was more theatrical than actual substance of business, and he was hyped a lot, you know. He was advised by the gang of crooks, really. Mm. This accountant who we had, who we fired because we couldn't stand him, a young guy, sent me a letter, I think, one day, saying, you're in chaos, you're losing, this is so much a week going out of Apple. You know, people are all saying, you sold out the dream of Apple. People were robbing us and living on us for the tune of fucking 18 or 20,000 pound a week was rolling out of Apple like that, and nobody was doing anything about it. All our buddies that worked for us for 50 years, all just living and drinking and eating like fucking Rome, man. And I suddenly realised it. And I said it to you, we're losing money at such a rate that we would have been broke, really broke. We didn't have anything in the bank, really. None of us did. Paul and I could have probably floated, you know, but we would have just sunk in a, we were sinking fast, you know. It was just hell. And it had to stop.
John was the one who went to Paul and said, look, I'm tired of it, I want the group over, it's over, I'm out of it. Paul then begs John not to make this announcement. Please, you can't say this, let's not break up. John clearly had made up his mind, finally wasn't going back. So in the interim, Paul takes the opportunity to go record his solo album, and as part of the public relations for his solo album, announces the breakup and puts out an interview.
Well, I said to Paul, I'm leaving. I hadn't decided how to do it. to have a permanent new group or what. And then later on I thought, fuck it, I'm not going to get stuck with another set of people, you know. Then we were discussing something in the office with Paul, and I kept saying no to everything he said, you see. So it came to a point I had to say something. And Paul said, well, what do you mean? And so I said, I mean, the group's over, I'm leaving. So that's what happened. Well, I mean, like anybody, when you say divorce, you know, the face goes all sorts of colours. It's like he knew really that this was the final thing, you know. And then 6 months later, he comes out with whatever, you know. I was a fool not to do what Paul did, which is use it to sell a record.
You were really angry with Paul.
No, I wasn't angry.
Well, when he came out with his "I'm leaving."
Well, I wasn't angry. I was just shit, you know. I mean, he's a good PR man, Paul. I mean, he's about the best in the world, probably. You know? He really does a job. I wasn't angry in that way. We were all hurt that he didn't tell us what he was going to do, but I think he claims that he didn't mean that to happen, but that's bullshit. He called me in the afternoon of that day and said, I'm doing what you and Yoko were doing
last year.
And I said, good, you know, because the time last year they were all looking at us too, as if we were strange, trying to make a life together and doing other things than being fab fat myths. So he rang me up that day and said, I'm doing what you and Yoko are doing and putting out an album, and I'm leaving the group too, he said. I said, good, you know. I was a little, you know, feeling a little strange, because he was saying it this time, you know, although it was a year later, you know, because he was the one that wanted the Beatles most. You know. And then the Midnight Papers came out, you know. And I was cursing because I hadn't done it. Not a chance. I wouldn't record with anyone again. I mean, I record with Yoko, but I'm not going to record with another egomaniac. There's only room for one on an album nowadays, you know, and so there's no point, you know. There's just no point at all. There was a reason to do it one time, but there's no reason to do it anymore.
Would you take it all back?
What?
Being a Beagle?
If I could be a fucking fisherman, I would. You know, if I had the capabilities of being something other than I am, I would. It's no fun being an artist. It's torture.
There's nobody like him. Especially now, there's nobody who's really speaking out. So it's almost like a very precious phenomenon. God is a cunt. By which we measure. In his driven way, he was really telling it like it was. And John laid it out for all of us in a way. You know, he just put a little truth serum in there. You know, we can experience it, but we don't have to die for it, whereas he did. We measure our.
He's one of the great men of the 20th century, and very sad that he's gone. One of the greatest people I ever met, you know, and it was painful for me to listen to his music from that era. Genius as it is, beautiful as it is, it's hard because you miss him so much.
People like me are aware of their genius, so-called, at 10, 8, 9. I always thought, why has nobody discovered me? In school, can they see that I'm cleverer than anybody in this school? That the teachers are stupid too? I mean, I didn't become aware of it in the Beatle thing. I got fucking lost in that, like being at high school or something. I used to say to my auntie, you throw my fucking poetry out, and you'll regret it when I'm famous. And she threw the bastard stuff out. I never forgave her.
for not treating me like a fucking genius or whatever I was when I was a child. It was obvious to me. I was different. I was always different. Why didn't anybody notice me?
Moment by moment, that's how we're living now. We're cherishing each day and dreading it too, you know. It might be your last. I mean, it sounds funny, but you might get run over by a car, all that. I'm really beginning to cherish it when I'm cherishing it. Yeah. I don't believe in Beatles.
I just believe in me.
Lennon, The Wenner Tapes, was produced by Simon Hollis. It was engineered by Chris O'Shaughnessy and was a Brooke Lapping production for BBC Radio 4.